Now, this past week marked the release of a controversial book that has been reported to have a recurring theme. The efforts of the president's aides to control his impulses, hiding papers so he can't sign them, and talking the president down from what were viewed as bad ideas. Well, time will ultimately surely tell how much of this book is fabricated stories by former disgruntled employees, or whether Bob Woodward's work has some bearing on the truth in the matter. The book is full of political and presidential drama, detailing the inner workings of backroom conversations. As readers get a portrayal of working political life in the White House, and where many important and significant decisions are made and contemplated. I think today's passage is somewhat similar. The book makes one ask, just who is actually in charge here? What kind of leader is the president, the most powerful person on this planet? What kind of leader is that? Today's passage asks those very same questions. Just who is in charge here? And what kind of king is Jesus? There's full of similar drama and dynamic as we see the scenes focus on Pontius Pilate, who is the ruling minister or the governor. Actually, he was Pontius Pilate, the procurator, which meant that he was the minister of finance and taxation for Judea, and he had the equivalent power of any other governor, and he was ruling a secondary state. So he was autonomous in power. He answered directly to Caesar, and any other kings would have to go through him if they had any issues with him directly. So the dynamic and the shift of the drama in this passage focuses on Pontius Pilate, but also his true lack of power. As he is pushed back and forth between the interactions with the Jewish leaders and the crowd outside and his interrogation of Jesus in his own palace, Pilate himself is involved in a tug of war inside his own heart, and his verdict remains in doubt until the very final scene that we saw. And as readers in the audience, we're forced to ask ourselves again and again, who's actually in charge here? Is Pilate actually in charge? It certainly does not seem like it's Pilate, although he has all the governing legislative power and the military might that affords him in his position. It seems like it's the king of the Jews who might actually be in power. And it's actually maybe the king of the Jews, Jesus, who has Pilate on trial. And yet, just what kind of king is this Jesus, we might ask ourselves. The stage for Jesus' trial is set when the Jewish authorities bring Jesus from Caiaphas's house to the Praetorium, which is the palace. It's kind of like the provincial legislature. Early in the morning, it was common for the Roman officials to begin their work early and complete their business just as soon as possible so they could go out to the veranda and enjoy the luxury of their position. Having already decided that one man should die for the people back in John 11, you might recall the chief priest saying that, the Jewish authorities then bring Jesus to Pilate so the death penalty can be imposed and blame then can be assigned to Rome. Their hands would be wiped clean. Only the Roman government could decide the death penalty. So if you haven't yet opened your Bibles to today's passage, I would invite you to do so now. We're going to John chapter 18, just at the end of that passage, right into the middle of chapter 19. So just a little bit of background and context to today's passage. Now, in the accounts described in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, the chronology is different from that of the Gospel of John. All four Gospels are making a statement through their storytelling. They're trying to cultivate an image and an idea of what is happening here in the Passion, that Jesus and his disciples all celebrate the Passover meal. They're all sharing the Last Supper. And by means of the Last Supper imagery, chapter 14 in Mark, the Gospels are saying that Jesus' coming death will be like a Passover sacrifice. We take that for granted now in our modern day, but way back then, this was one of the biggest celebrations that the Jewish community had, was the Passover feast. And then they'd go into a time of worship. And so the four Gospels are trying to say Jesus is this Passover sacrifice. Jesus dies in John's Gospel, today's passage. Jesus dies at the very time the Passover lambs are being slaughtered. They're declaring that Jesus is the new Passover lamb. That's what John's trying to do. And once again, all four Gospels agree that Jesus was crucified and buried before sundown on Friday, and that the empty tomb was vacated and discovered on Sunday morning, and that these events happened at the time of the Jewish Passover. So there's a lot of action going on here. So I'm going to split today's passage into seven scenes. We're going to go through them pretty quickly, just so we can try to follow along with what's happening. So please hang on tight. Scene one here is verses 28 to 32. In the first scene, Pilate comes out from his palace. Just imagine that. He's coming out from his palace because the Jews would not enter. So, who has the power here? When Pilate tells the Jews to judge Jesus according to their own law, they say that they cannot execute Jesus. What they really want is Jesus to be hung on a Roman cross. You see, the Jewish leaders are projecting purity. Their hands are clean. All the while, they are maneuvering to have Jesus crucified. And how the plot thickens from here. Move right into scene two, which is verses 33 to 38. So in the second scene where Jesus is interrogated under trial by Pilate, the tables are now turned. Normally, under Roman law, there is no trial by jury. Since Jesus was not a Roman citizen, Pilate had some freedom in dealing with this particular situation. So normally, Pilate would interrogate the accuser and the accused. He would also interrogate any witnesses, and then he would decide a verdict. If the accused is found guilty, then Pilate would also declare the penalty. Okay, so there was the interrogations of the accuser, the accused, witnesses, and then a verdict. So in verse 33, Pilate asks, "Are you the king of the Jews?" to Jesus. And Jesus, however, in verse 34, look with me there, he turns the tables around by putting Pilate on trial. "Are you saying this on your own? Is this an accusation that you're coming up with yourself, or have someone else told you this about me?" Jesus asks Pilate about his own identity. Who do you say I am? Because the real issue is whether Pilate will acknowledge Jesus' identity and believe in him. But Pilate is an experienced politician, and so he's evasive. So instead of going down the King of the Jews trail, Pilate asks what Jesus has done. He just skips over that, and he says, "So what have you done?" And Jesus responds that his kingship is not of this world. If it were of this world, he would have had soldiers fighting to protect him. Now, it's important to understand that Jesus is not contrasting a heavenly or an invisible kingdom with the power politics of earthly nations that we see on Fox News or CBC or CNN. Instead, Jesus is contrasting two spheres with two very different ways of operating in this world. Our world operates on the basis of deadly or coercive force. Jesus offers life and persuades others by the word of truth, seeking to serve God in the power of the Spirit of love. And so in verse 37, Pilate asks, "So, Jesus, are you a king?" And Jesus, once again, he responds by saying, "Well, you said it yourself." But Jesus chooses to define himself quite differently as a witness to the truth. Jesus adds, "Everyone who is on the side of truth listens to me." And Pilate famously then answers, "Well, what is truth?" And maybe it's a question of exasperation. What's truth? The thing is, the real issue for Pilate wasn't actually truth. Rather, the real issues are who has the power, who has the political muscle. Truth is secondary for Pilate, perhaps maybe even irrelevant. I think what he was asking was more of a rhetorical question. What is truth? He wasn't looking for an answer. Is the truth about Jesus irrelevant? Or is political expediency the primary issue for Pilate here? How do I get this problem off my plate? I just want to move on with my day and then go out to the veranda and do some, you know, manicuring of my tomatoes and go and check my horses, inspect the troops, feel like I'm a powerful governor. I want to get on with my life. How do I keep from getting Rome further involved here? That's what Pilate was probably thinking as a practical politician. Now, the irony here is that while Jesus stands on trial before Pilate, under God, it is Pilate who is actually being tried and found guilty. Jesus, in chapter 14, declares that he is truth personified. He is the way, the truth, and the life. Truth is a person. And what God has revealed in Jesus is the seemingly impotent, but very true power of self-giving, nonviolent love. Let's move on to scene 3, near the tail end of chapter 18, verses 38 to 40. Just go to verse 38 again. Pilate goes outside once again. So he's going outside, checking with the leaders, going inside, talking to Jesus, going outside again to check with the crowds here. So who's actually in charge here? Oh, just a minute, I'm going to talk to Jesus. Just a minute, I'm going to talk to the crowd. Like, he's back and forthing. Who's in charge? And then he goes outside, he pronounces, "Jesus, I see no basis for a charge against this man. He's innocent." And incredibly declares, "I find him innocent. So, done. Let's go. Let's move on. My day. Next." So Pilate has now reached a verdict, and he's pronounced it publicly. So in Roman law, it's done. It's finished. Public proclamation. Let's move on. Next trial. Now Pilate knows Jesus is not guilty, yet he abdicates his decision, and in an effort to appease the crowd, because now there's murmuring happening after he says that, he makes a populist move. And he refers to a custom of releasing a prisoner at Passover. Notice the irony here in verse 40. The people choose Barabbas. Now, historical documents would also call him Jesus Barabbas, or son of Barabbas. Jesus was actually a very common name in Jesus' day. It was just a rendering of Joshua. It's the Greek rendering for Joshua. So a lot of people would be called Yeshua, same as Mark or David or Scott today. Very common names in our culture. Well, Yeshua was very common then too. And so the people choose Jesus, Barabbas, over Jesus of Nazareth. John refers to Barabbas as the real insurrectionist, the real revolutionary, the one who is trying to join a messianic movement to militarily, through a coup, overthrow the Roman powers with swords and a whole group of zealots, or modern-day terrorists, let's say. They're trying to overthrow the status quo. And the people choose this person, a militaristic revolutionary, over the king, the Prince of Peace, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus Barabbas was found guilty of the very crime of which the innocent Jesus was actually accused. Do you see the irony here? It just thickens. Move on to scene 4, the first three verses of chapter 19. Pilate has Jesus flogged. And Kenneth, if you can put Isaiah 56 there. The soldiers mock Jesus by placing a crown made of thorns on his head, clothing him in the imperial color of purple, and hailing him as the King of the Jews, fulfilling the prophecy in Isaiah 50, verse 6. "I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheeks to those who pulled out the beard. I did not hide my face from insult and spitting." This brief scene is chock full of irony. Although the soldiers mock Jesus as a king with a crown and a purple robe, in reality, Jesus is God's royal son who will be lifted up in resurrection and ascension to glory. Unwittingly, as the Roman soldiers are lambasting him with insults, they bow before their Lord. Scene 5, verses 4 to 7. Pilate once again goes outside and brings Jesus with him and presents him to the people. Okay, I've beaten him up. I've softened him up. Good. Can we move on with the day now? And Jesus is wearing his purple robe and crown of thorns, and he is torn apart. He's beaten up pretty badly. And for the second time, Pilate pronounces Jesus is innocent. In verse 5 of chapter 19, the TNIV says, "Here is the man." A better rendering of this verb from the Greek would be, "Behold," or "Look at this pathetic little man." with an intention to belittle. Here is your son of man, Pilate would be saying. Can you sense the patronism? Again, unwittingly announcing Jesus' messianic status, because we all know from a biblical standpoint what son of man actually means. Back in Isaiah, he was this God figure, powerful, son of man. All of heaven and earth bows before him. And here's Pilate insulting him. Here's their son of man. He doesn't realize who he's standing before. Pilate, the legislative power of this little Roman area, is too weak to stop the proceedings and the crowd near riot status now. And they begin yelling, "Crucify him!" And it gets louder. It sounds horrible. Once again, in verse 6, Pilate desperately says, "You know, folks, calm down. He's innocent. I've said it. Didn't you hear me? This is the third time. He's innocent. Third time." Notice how three has been used a lot, as Peter denies Jesus three times. And at the end of John, Jesus reinstates Peter by saying, "Do you love me?" three times. Here, "He's innocent. He's innocent. He's innocent. Crucify him. Crucify him. Crucify him." It gets louder and louder every single time. And the religious authorities accuse Jesus of blasphemy, and he wants him dead because Jesus offered himself to the people as the Son of God, a title solely used by the Romans to refer to the office of the emperor himself. The emperor's face and effigy is on the back of a coin. It says Son of God on there. Now that got Pilate's attention. Ooh. Because if he doesn't do anything, he's answerable to the emperor himself, because the people can go and say, "Hey, Caesar, Pilate isn't doing anything to back you up." People are calling this rabble-rouser, Jesus of Nazareth, they're calling him Son of God. Only you're Son of God. What are you going to do? So Pilate does the math in his head, and he says, "Okay, I've got to do something here, or else I'm dead." So scene 6, chapter 19, verses 8 to 11. Pilate now asks Jesus, he's a little bit desperate, "So where are you from?" And Jesus is quiet. In fact, he's silent, fulfilling more prophecy in Isaiah 53:7. Pilate loses it. Jesus' silence is just exasperating for him. And he appeals to his own authority over Jesus. "Don't you know I have the power to free you or to torture and then ultimately kill you?" And here is where today's passage hits its climax. Jesus reminds Pilate in verse 11 that his authority has been given to him from above. He says, "Pilate, your authority has been from above." And that means the emperor, and ultimately by God himself. Jesus is saying to Pilate, "The source of your power, Pilate, ultimately comes from the God of love." That's true power. Then we move to the final scene, verses 12 to 16. In this final scene, Pilate brings Jesus outside once again, the last of the back and forthing. And he makes one more attempt to release Jesus, and the crowd shouts back, and this is their trump card, "If you release this man, you're not Caesar's friend." They know how to get him. They've got him now. In this way, the crowd appeals to Pilate's source of authority and fear, frankly. If Pilate releases Jesus, the crowd will imply that Pilate has betrayed his responsibility to Caesar. And then this is where Caesar would come in and say, "Okay, Pilate, kill yourself. Don't even bother to get your Roman guards to kill you. Commit suicide." That was common in the Roman days. At the heart of the issue is Jesus' claim of kingship in verse 12 of chapter 19. And since Jesus has claimed kingship, he is clearly an insurrectionist, according to the chief priests. He's an anarchist. He is a terrorist threat. So at this, Jesus is brought out. And Pilate sits Jesus down on the bema seat, the judgment seat, at a place called Gabbatha, the stone pavement, or the raised up place. I was there a couple years ago. Pilate intentionally puts Jesus on the judge's bench or throne. It's the judgment seat, actually, as if Jesus is to judge his accusers. And in a scene of seemingly political parody, he says, Pilate could be mocking or engaging in political theatrics. Either way, he is evading a decision until his hand is finally forced. And go to verse 14 here. Right at this point, John reminds us it's now the time of the day when the priests were slaughtering the lambs for Passover. Right at this moment when Jesus is being seated on this judgment seat where the judge would normally sit down and pronounce judgments, the seat of authority, this is when the lambs are being slaughtered for Passover. John wants us to observe that Jesus was crucified and judged, and he died on the afternoon of the day when the Passover lambs were being slaughtered. Pilate then tauntingly says, "Behold your king," sitting in this judgment seat. "Behold your king. Look." A comment both loaded with sarcasm, but also declaring a theological truth at the very same time. Do you see the rich irony that John is portraying this with? And the scene comes to a close as the crowd demands that Pilate then crucify Jesus, who's sitting on the judgment seat, the seat of authority where Pilate should be sitting. And Pilate ducks out of the political wrinkle by asking the Jews, "Well then, shall I crucify your king?" In response to Pilate's taunt and in an appealing, an appalling act of abandoning their beliefs, the chief priests, okay, not the people, but the chief priests declare, "We have no king but Caesar." Ooh. These are the chief priests who, in the Old Testament, say, "We have no king but Yahweh, God, the Lord of Lords." They are the ones who are now committing terrible blasphemy themselves by denying the kingship of God. And the trial is now over. Pilate has escaped the political wrinkle for him by getting crowds and the religious authorities to vow allegiance to Caesar. Oof. Well, Pilate also knows that he has just sentenced an innocent man to die a very cruel death on a cross. Let's take this home. Despite his legislative power, Pilate thinks he's in charge, but who is really in charge here? Is it Jesus who's in charge? Is Jesus really the one who's on trial? Or is it Pilate? It seems like the lines have blurred a little bit, and then they disappear entirely. For us, we need to ask ourselves, who's in charge of us? Who's in charge of our lives? Is it our ambition? Is it our desires? Is it our plans for the future? Or is it someone else? Does our faith in King Jesus influence where our locus of control actually lies? If King Jesus is indeed in charge of our lives, his throne is a cross. That's Jesus' throne. His dominion is the place of the skull where he died. If King Jesus is in charge, he rules very differently than the powers of our world. Instead of using sheer brutality and deadly force or coercion, Jesus rules through broken love. He rules through vulnerability. He rules through suffering care and self-sacrificial love. What a strange ruler. So as we follow King Jesus in his footsteps, let us be a people who respond to the world and all that is around us with active love in the same way Jesus shared his. Thanks be to God. Amen.